Father, thank you for this chance to come and pause in the middle of our day. We know lots of people here are in lots of different places and are new to considering the things of God. Just pray you'd help us to hear what you want to say to us this day. I pray that for your glory. Amen. So our practice here normally is just to open up the next bit of the Bible, and we're in Luke, and so we've got to Luke chapter 5, verse 33. You'll see on the inside of the sheets there, or you can read it on the Bibles on the table, and we just want to see what it's got to say to us. So let me read a bigger section than the last few times, because I realised it was going to take me a long time to get through Luke's Gospel at the pace I was going. So 5, verse 33, and the Pharisees said to Jesus, the disciples of John fast often and offer prayers, and so do the disciples of the Pharisees, but yours eat and drink. And Jesus said to them, can you make wedding guests fast while the bridegroom is with them? The days will come when the bridegroom is taken away from them, and then they will fast in those days. He also told them a parable, no one tears a piece from a new garment and puts it on an old garment. If he does, he will tear the new, and the piece from the new will not match the old. And no one puts new wine into old wineskins. If he does, the new wine will burst the skins, and it will be spilled, and the skins will be destroyed. But new wine must be put into fresh wineskins. And no one, after drinking old wine, desires new, for he says the old is good. On a Sabbath, while Jesus was going through the grain fields, his disciples plucked and ate some heads of grain, rubbing them in their hands. But some of the Pharisees said, why are you doing what is not lawful to do on the Sabbath? And Jesus answered them, have you not read what David did when he was hungry, he and those who were with him? How he entered the house of God and took and ate the bread of the presence, which is not lawful for any but the priest to eat, and also gave it to those with him. And he said to them, the Son of Man is Lord of the Sabbath. And on another Sabbath he entered the synagogue and was teaching, and a man was there whose right hand was withered. And the scribes and the Pharisees watched him to see whether he would heal on the Sabbath, so that they might find a reason to accuse him. But Jesus knew their thoughts, and he said to the man with the withered hand, come, stand here. And he rose and stood there. And Jesus said to them, I ask you, is it lawful on the Sabbath to do good or to do harm, to save life or to destroy it? And after looking around at them all, he said to him, stretch out your hand. And he did so, and his hand was restored. But they were filled with fury and discussed with one another what they might do to Jesus. In these days he went out to the mountain to pray, and all night he continued in prayer to God. And when day came, he called his disciples and chose from them 12, whom he named apostles. Simon, who he named Peter, and Andrew his brother, and James and John, and Philip and Bartholomew, and Matthew and Thomas, and James the son of Alphaeus, and Simon who was called the Zealot, and Judas, the son of James, and Judas Iscariot, who became a traitor. Great. The Brexit confrontation is underway, isn't it? So you've got, I don't know what colour you want to assign to them. In the red corner, you've got Donald Tusk, Michel Barnier. In the blue corner, you've got David Davies. You've got, God forbid, Boris Johnson. The confrontation's underway. What's the divorce bill going to be? Are we going to have free market access? What's the immigration policy going to be? The confrontation is underway, isn't it? This passage is about a different confrontation, a confrontation between Jesus and religion, okay? A confrontation between Jesus and religion. Now, maybe to you that sentence doesn't make any sense. Surely Jesus is about religion, right? It depends what you mean by religion. But if by religion you mean man's attempt, humanity's attempt to get right with God by what they do, then Jesus is fundamentally opposed to religion. Jesus thinks the way you get right with God is by admitting you are a failure and asking him for mercy. Good works follow as a necessary consequence. But it's not about what you do. And this passage is about a confrontation between Jesus and religion. Two points there on the sheets. Religion confronts Jesus, and Jesus confronts religion. You can see the conflict in the world today. You can see Christians being martyred in seemingly religious countries. You can see it in society as the religion of secular tolerance tries to do the thought police thing on Christians. You can see it in the church as the Church of England does the splits with two different factions with opposite worldviews. You can see it in the 500th year anniversary that we're celebrating in October, the Reformation. There is a conflict. Luke was writing to Theophilus. You can see that in the first chapter. And his friend Theophilus, he was writing to give him certainty, confidence about what's been taught. And Theophilus was sitting there going, well, if Jesus is right, why are all the religious leaders, why are they rejecting Jesus? Have I backed the wrong horse here? He's writing to give confidence. Maybe as you see biblical Christianity marginalized around you, you think, well, have I backed the right horse here? Or maybe you're not a Christian here, and you look at the spats that seem to happen within church life and between different sets of God-botherers, and you just think, this is proof positive that I don't want to get involved in this Jesus thing. But we need to see the difference between the message Jesus brings and the difference and man-made religion. So first point there on your sheets, religion confronts Jesus. Religion confronts Jesus. This passage and this whole section of Luke's gospel has a crescendo of opposition. So I enjoyed watching the All Blacks taking on the Lions in the recent test series. And before every match, the All Blacks would pull out their haka. I won't do a full impression, but you know, it starts relatively quiet. So you've got Ringa Pakia, Umatiraha, and it gets louder and louder. I won't, Kamate, Kamate. It gets louder and louder. Kamate, Kamate means it is death. It is death. That's what it means. The crescendo to the end builds and builds. And apparently teams have to go through intensive anti-hacker training so that they don't get so psyched out by it that they concede tries in the first 10 minutes. There is a crescendo of opposition in this passage. In the passage before, the Pharisees and their scribes grumbled to Jesus' disciples, why do you eat and drink with tax collectors and sinners? Don't associate with those bad people. Come and spend time with us. At the beginning of this section, they ask him about fasting. Why aren't your disciples fasting enough, Jesus? In 6 verse 2, some of the Pharisees see his disciples doing what is not lawful on the Sabbath, taking some grain. Why are they doing that? Theresa May was asked in the election, what's the naughtiest thing you've ever done as a kid growing up? And the best she could come up with was running through fields of wheat. Well, here's Jesus doing something supposedly naughty in a field of wheat. There you go, that's your 21st century relevance for the passage. 6 verse 7, here is the final crescendo moment. Jesus is in a synagogue on a Sabbath, and there's a man with a withered right hand. And the scribes and the Pharisees watch him in verse 7. Why do they watch him? To see if he would heal on the Sabbath so that they might have a reason to accuse him. There's no rationality. There's the pre-decided disposition to find a reason to accuse him. And then they watch Jesus heal a man with a shriveled hand. They watch the hand grow in front of them. And how do they respond? You know, they get down on their knees and they bow to Jesus as Lord and Savior. No. 6 verse 11. They are filled with fury and they discuss what they might do to Jesus. Plots that end up putting Jesus to death on a cross. This passage is about a crescendo of confrontation. So that's what the parables in 5 verse 36 to 39 are all about. They're pretty weird when you first look at them, but they're all about the old and its interaction with the new. So the old, the Pharisees, their moralistic understanding of the Old Testament, and the new, the message Jesus brought of grace. So 5 verse 36 says, no one tears a piece from a new garment and puts it on an old garment. They're fundamentally different. If he does, he will tear the new, and the piece from the new will not match the old. You cannot bring the old and new together. They don't match. And the new will end up torn. Or 5 verse 39, no one after drinking old wine desires new, for he says the old is good. I'm just trying to make one basic point. Those that love the old, they don't want the new. They don't want the message of Jesus. The conflict is obvious, isn't it? That's what this passage is all about, the conflict. The thing that's harder to work out, I guess, is why. Why is this conflict in evidence? I want you to picture the scene. I wake up in the morning and I look in the mirror and I just think to myself, oh, that's it. That face is not helping you today. It's never been helping you. It's been holding you back. You're inflicting that face on other people. Just be kind to other people. Put a mask up. Hide away that ugly mug, and maybe you'll get further in life. Stupid example, right? But that is what we do all the time in society. We try and hide away our bad bits and flaunt, put a positive spin on our good bits. Do you know that you can, on LG phones now, they have something called an airbrush filter, so that when you're taking your selfie, you can just put the airbrush filter on, and it just sort of covers over your blemishes. People are going to go out and buy LG phones now, aren't they? I hope not. It just makes you look like a doll. It just covers over your blemishes. Or people just get their Instagram accounts and they just carefully curate which pictures go up there so that they look their best. Or take 30 Instagram shots and then choose the one that makes them look best. Well, the Bible thinks that all of us do that, morally speaking. We hide away the bad, and we try and put only the good on display. We try and cover over how bad we are. Ever since Adam and Eve in the garden sin, reject God, they take fig leaves. They try and mask themselves, hide away. You see, the Pharisees, they react with vitriol as Jesus treats the Sabbath and fasting as less important than they do for one very simple reason. They feel like Jesus is yanking down their mask. They've spent their whole life thinking, look how good I am. Look how often I fast. Look how well I keep the Sabbath. I am a good person. Look, look, look. And as Jesus tramples on their mask, they can feel deep down Jesus yanking down their mask, saying, no, that's not enough. You don't perform religiously to get into God's good books and stay in God's good books. You need to take down the mask, admit what you're like, and ask for forgiveness. And they hate it. They don't like to see what they're really like, and they don't like their mask to be pulled down. That is why, I think, as you look at the Bible, that is why these Pharisees react the way they do. Religion confronts Jesus. Application, don't be surprised, opposition. Humanity loves masks. We love to put up any kind of protection we can to hide what we're really like. Don't be surprised when people hate their masks being ripped up or pulled down. Other application, put down our masks. God sees past the mask anyway. He sees what we're like on our worst days as well as on our best days. He sees we need forgiveness. He's ready to offer forgiveness. Stop trying to pretend we can mask it and ask for forgiveness. It's hard to spot sometimes what we're treating as a mask and what's just a good thing we should be doing, you know, Sabbath, fasting, they were good things for the Jews to be doing. And yet here are some diagnostic questions that might help us work out whether we're treating something as a mask. What is it that causes us pride? What do we take massive pride in? You know, what do we casually drop into conversation, make sure everyone knows, post on social media? Do we post, look at me, I've just helped out another charity, I've just given on another Just Giving page, I've just given more time to serving at church. I take inordinate pride in that. Another diagnostic, the opposite of pride is despair. What is it that just, I'm just gripped by despair? Just like, I just hate it when people see me coming late into church or failing to make every single Bible study group or not being at lunchtime talks for a few weeks. I just hate it. Maybe we hate it in part because we've been treating those things as a mask to cover over our moral failures. Another one for me, what takes up too much time? What do I fixate on, desperate to get it right? So I actually do this, I think, with sermons sometimes. I'm just, you know, part of me, I just want to do a good job for you guys and help you understand the passage. But a little part of me thinks, I just want my talk to be spot on, to sound so religious and careful that you'll be impressed with me. And somehow, if I can impress you, well, maybe God will be impressed too. Maybe we spend, I've heard of people spending hours and hours and hours writing prayers that they're about to say on up at the front of church. And that's a great thing to do, but they're doing it because they want that moment when they're up there performing to be spot on, because they think it's part of their mask. Or a last diagnostic. Where's the heat? Where do you see just massive emotional intensity and vitriol? Often there'll be masks at play there. I think you can see that in some of the Church of England debates at the moment inside General Synods. As religion confronts Jesus, how does Jesus respond? Jesus responds by confronting religion, taking it on directly. Prince William was a few years ago on a ferry crossing the Channel, and he was slightly incognito, and he had a baseball cap pulled down over his head, and he walked up to the first class lounge with a friend and was trying to go in because he just thought that would be a quieter place to be, and but the stewardess didn't recognise him, so the stewardess asked to see his first class ticket, and she still didn't spot him. And he didn't have it, so she refused him entry. Now, Prince William has got kind of three options to how he could respond at that moment. He could have, you know, obediently trotted off, picked up his first class ticket, and bought it back and showed it, and showed he had the right to go in. Or he could have done what he actually did, which was to slink off into a corner and just forget all about it and laugh it off with his friends. Or he could have done something different. Which is to take off the cap and to look the lady in the face and say, I'm your future king. Let me in. I hope she'd have recognised by then. Maybe she could have pulled up a picture on his mobile or something just to make the point. We need to understand those different options to understand how Jesus answers the Pharisees in this section. So Jesus could have done the equivalent of trotting off and picking up his first class ticket and showed them that actually the way he was acting was in accordance with the real Old Testament law. So the Old Testament only commanded fasting once a year on the Day of Atonement. The Pharisees did it twice a week just to show off how amazing they were. He could have said about the Sabbath, look, and he says this later on in chapter 13, the Old Testament, it doesn't clearly define what constitutes work and what doesn't constitute work on the Sabbath. So you Pharisees, you untie your ox from the manger where it's feeding and lead it off to drink water, and you say that's not work, that doesn't count. But you say that what my disciples are doing in the field, that counts as work? You're hypocrites. You're just picking and choosing your rules. He could have said, look, I am keeping in accordance with the Old Testament law. But that's not what he does. Instead, he takes off the cap and says, look, I am your future king. Do you not know who I am? So in 5 verse 34, he identifies himself as the bridegroom. And the bridegroom is Old Testament charge language from Isaiah 61 and 62 of God's king that would come and marry God's people and bring them joy and blessing and celebration. That's who I am. They're with me. They're with the bridegroom. I'm the bridegroom. And as they accuse him of failing to keep the Sabbath, what does he say? He doesn't go with the technocratic answer. He says, verse 3, "Have you not read what King David did when he was hungry, he and those who were with him? He entered the house of God and took and ate the bread of the presence, which is not lawful for any but the priests to eat, and also gave it to those with him." But God's anointed King David, because he was king and because it was a moment of need, could break Old Testament ritual law. Old Testament regulations could be overridden by the king. That's Jesus' answer. Look who I am. I'm the king. Jesus confronts them as they confront him. He says, verse 5, "I'm the Son of Man. I'm Lord of the Sabbath, the Son of Man." This Daniel 7 picture of a coming king. The Pharisees, they just look so ridiculous, don't they? Their irrational hatred is exposed as they refuse to side with Jesus as he does good on the Sabbath and heals and restores this man. It's why the next section, Jesus goes up on a mountain and calls New Israel. So old Israel, 12 tribes, were called in a sense at Mount Sinai. And here's Jesus saying, look, I reject the old Pharisaical leaders. And here I am, I'm calling a new people. People who know their failures, who know they need mercy and yet turn to Jesus. I reject the old. I'm confronting the old. I'm calling the new. Jesus wins the confrontation, hands down. But maybe we're left asking with Theophilus, well, if you've won the confrontation, hands down, how come you're destroyed by them? How come you're led to the cross? In 5 verse 37, Jesus says he knows that's going to happen. So new wine is put in old wineskins. What happens? Jesus will burst the old skins. They will be destroyed. But what's going to happen to the new wine? The new wine is going to be spilled and presumably destroyed too on the floor. Now there's one other moment in Luke's gospel where wine gets spilled out or poured out, which is the same Greek word. And it's in Luke 22, verse 20, at the Last Supper. So as Jesus says, this cup, this wine, it's poured out for you. It's the new covenant in my blood. So this is Jesus' claim. He's not lost the contest. He's let his blood be poured out so that ours wouldn't have to be. We, in our sin and our failure, we deserve to die, to have our blood poured out. And yet Jesus says, I will let my blood be poured out in your place that you wouldn't have to. You can have the heaven you don't deserve as I take the hell you deserve. The king will pay a cost. Application, have confidence in the king. When you see religion's vitriol, don't fear. Jesus is in control. He wins that confrontation. And have confidence through the king. We don't need our masks anymore. We can rip them up. We can say, look, my performance doesn't... my status with God doesn't depend on my performance. I can serve in church joyfully. I don't need to be a perfectionist about it. My failure will always poke through somewhere. I don't need to parade my own performance. I can parade Jesus' performance on my behalf. I can say no to the bits of service I can't do without ignoring other responsibilities. I don't need to keep polishing my mask and flogging myself harder and harder. How does it apply in the wharf? I guess most of us here will have been people who have been told our whole lives at school and now at work, look, just perform and we'll love you more. Keep performing, and we'll love you, and don't fail. Do not fail. And we can so easily bring that into our Christianity, think that's how it works with God. But we hear it's free forgiveness, not dependent on what we do. And that can transfer back into our workplace, that the fear of failure doesn't need to grip us anymore. we can trust Jesus and accept his forgiveness and know that our status ultimately depends on him and not on us. Obviously, we'll want to work hard in his service, but it doesn't ultimately control our final status. Let me pray, and then be a chance for people to ask any questions about some of the stuff I've been saying. I realise it's been a long passage, so I've necessarily skipped over a couple of points. Father, thank you that your son and his offer of mercy means we can drop the pretense, we can drop the mask, we can admit what we're really like. Please help us to do that. Praise you so much that your son was ready to have his blood poured out for our forgiveness. In Jesus' name, amen.